Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This week, we reach beyond our studios and bring you interviews from Wyoming PBS's Wyoming Chronicle. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. We hear from the current director.
It's not about regulation and regulating things. It's about innovations. It's about finding solutions and helping industry navigate through the variety of regulations that they might have for air quality, water quality, etc.
Aaron Mulkey is a famous ice climber who has been pushing boundaries in the South Fork Canyon near Cody.
And so until those places are all explored and I feel like everything has been touched and everything has been seen, I'll keep having my addiction.
Join us for those stories on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. On the next Open Spaces, we revisit two older episodes of the Wyoming PBS show Wyoming Chronicle. The South Fork Canyon near Cody has the highest concentration of ice falls in the lower 48.
You get to go and climb this thing that nobody's ever seen, ever been on.
And it's the 50th anniversary of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. Tune in Friday at 3 and Sunday at noon on Wyoming Public Radio.
Pleased to be joined today by Todd Parfit, who's the director of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, and by John Turner, who was around as a Wyoming legislator at the beginning of the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality. Welcome to you both, and thanks especially to you, John Turner, for welcoming us into your onto your beautiful property and lovely home here in Teton County. Good to have you both with us. Todd, let's start with you. DEQ is here marking its 50th anniversary here in the nearing the end of the first quarter of the 21st century. 50 years in, how would you describe what the DEQ is to viewers who might not be familiar?
Yeah, this is a milestone for the agency. It's the 50th year, and we had a great foundation with the start of the Environmental Quality Act back in 1973. And since that time, the agency has grown, taken on additional responsibilities. We started out with four divisions. We had water, air quality, solid waste, which was underwater quality, and then land quality. And since that time, we've expanded the agency, working through the legislature and with the legislature and different governors over the years, and taking on more responsibilities, which includes taking on the Industrial Siting Act, which, as we were talking about here just a little bit ago, includes siting of wind projects, solar projects, large industrial construction projects, and looking at the socioeconomic impacts and how do we mitigate some of those impacts from those projects. Some of the other things that have occurred over the years, we've taken on more responsibilities related to landfills, helping out small communities to find better ways to manage solid waste. We've taken on the hazardous waste program and primacy for that. More recently, we've taken on the responsibilities for uranium mining and milling, and working with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to become an agreement state with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we're in the process of expanding that agreement. Very recent times, we've taken on the primacy for the Class 6, what they call Class 6 underground injection control program, which is carbon capture and sequestration, very important to the state and the economy of the state. We're one of only two states in the country that have primacy for that program.
So DEQ is bigger than it was then. How many employees in the agency now?
Right now, we're about 261 employees.
And where does that rate on the scale of big to small in Wyoming state government?
I would characterize us as a medium-sized agency. Department of Transportation, Department of Health are much larger than the DEQ.
John Turner, we're looking back 50 years now. You were a young legislator, elected when you were 28 years old?
27, I think. I was elected in 1970, a young whippersnapper wildlife student. I had hair then.
So did I.
But thinking back through the beginning of DEQ is pretty gratifying, and seeing what the leadership at DEQ, the dedicated staff, oh my gosh, the dedication and efforts of the council.
Now, when you say the council, you're referring to what?
The Environmental Quality Council, seven citizens around Wyoming appointed by the governor, who come down and work with the staff on standards, regulations, permits, timing, pretty important role.
And at the beginning, DEQ and the Environmental Quality Act that accompanied it, those were initiatives from the legislature. And you were pivotal in that as a very young man, a Republican, launching or helping to launch and drive this environmental-based legislation. Had to have been a very interesting process for you in particular to get involved with. What do you remember about how that began?
Well, thinking back, I guess I ran for the Wyoming legislature because of a interest in natural resource policy for Wyoming. And so in the late 60s, early 70s, communities, Wyoming people, all of us were looking at a major energy boom. At the time, we had a very rudimentary legislation on open pit mining. My gosh, it was a small part of the Wyoming statutes. I think you just had to post a bond and go mine. And a lot of us figured that was inadequate. How do we prepare for these large mining activities that are projected? So in those days, we didn't have staff. We didn't have the internet. I can remember going to the library, getting Kentucky, Ohio, Illinois, Pennsylvania statutes, taking them to my log cabin here at the ranch, going through them. What would work for Wyoming in the way of headwalls and hydrology and separating topsoil from undercover stuff? And how are we going to prepare for Wyoming? And so I drafted myself a pretty comprehensive land reclamation bill. Malcolm Wallop from Bighorn.
Well, let's just tell viewers who Malcolm was. You're talking about who he was then.
Malcolm was a state legislator, became a state senator, and then, of course, a very distinguished, effective United States senator on behalf of Wyoming Senate. So he had also introduced a bill on open pit mining. My bill had a council. We're going to have Wyoming citizens help drive this, because quite frankly, we didn't know if we could even reclaim Wyoming open lands. We're talking about parts of Wyoming, thin topsoils, very little moisture, high wind, short growing season, even range ecologists, the industry, we're going to give it our best shot. But we thought to have Wyoming citizens help steer that regulation, look at the science, listen to communities around Wyoming. So I had a council to house this new regulatory system. A wonderful legislator, an oil and gas man from Casper, just very distinguished, by the name of Warren Morton, came to me and he said, "John, I like the idea of a council as an entity to do open pit." He said, "I think we can do more with that. I think it can be a platform, a watering hole for a lot of other environmental challenges." That was the origin of the Environmental Quality Council and the department. And then I had the opportunity to serve for another 20 years. And so we created an infrastructure that we could do air quality, we could do groundwater, we could do leaking underground storage tanks. We had a lot of service stations around with leaking gas tanks. We're getting into the watershed. We did solid waste management. I sponsored that one.
I like hearing the history of this, and off camera you mentioned who a young legal assistant was at the time you were doing, just starting this work. Tell us who she was.
Oh, yes. Well, we all needed help. We didn't have lawyers or anybody to help us as legislators, so I had a kind of a secret source down in the base of the state capitol, and she was an assistant attorney general, really interested and skilled in environmental law, and her name was Marilyn Kite.
And she...
Marilyn on weekends would subversively meet with me, and we'd go over statutes and stuff I wrote. And of course, then she became interested enough, legal counsel to the department subsequently, and then, of course, a wonderful distinguished career on the Wyoming Supreme Court.
Including as Chief Justice later. Todd Parfit, as the director now, you're looking back on this framework that was being established then. Is it continuing to serve Wyoming well?
Yeah, I think it's serving Wyoming extremely well. We're engaged in conversations on the national level through our different media associations, and that provides us the opportunity to share with other states, other federal agencies, how things operate in Wyoming, what's important to Wyoming, considerations that need to be taken into account as we develop or modify existing regulations.
This was just at the dawn of when Powder River Basin coal mining was about to begin and transforming really the energy industry of the entire nation in a way, the concentration, the volume, the new production methods, the new mining methods, the new transportation methods of coal that had never been seen anywhere in the country before. This is the kind of thing that was being anticipated and led, part of what led you and your fellow legislators to think we've got to be prepared for this.
Well, that question prompts me to think back to the quality of legislators we had. School teachers, lawyers, railroad people, ranchers, people that really wanted to do what was right for Wyoming. And I think of the Tom Strucks and the Rex Arneys and the Roger McDaniels, and I admitted too many, but people that really cared about Wyoming's future. It wasn't about them. Very bipartisan. We might disagree on things, but we tried not to be disagreeable. You respected one another, you listened, you had to listen, because we came from diverse opinions and backgrounds. But if you listened to what our mutual interests might be and where we could mold a path forward, those were interesting days. And I think during that time, Wyoming was blessed with some pretty hardworking, effective legislators to put in place some things that have served Wyoming well and in some ways been the envy of other states.
It's just so interesting to hear you talking about it now, and a man such as Warren Morton, a candidate for governor later in his career, an oil man who was involved heavily in crafting environmental policy for Wyoming, and not necessarily or explicitly for the benefit of the oil business.
Really diverse. Let's learn all we can and let's prepare Wyoming for the future.
I mean, 50 years later, it's just almost a knee-jerk reaction to suppose that no Republican Wyoming oil man, for example, would want to be looking favorably on new environmental regulation. I may be wrong about that too. It's now become a way of life, and nobody in the energy industry in the state can operate that way at all. What's happened is, would you agree, Todd Parfit, that a lot of times nowadays, it's the energy industry that is the most roll-up-your-shirt-sleeves people that are involved in actual water quality, reclamation, land quality work, because they have to be.
Yeah, you know, that's very true, and it's about a culture.
Good way to put it.
There's a culture with not only within the agency, and our culture is it's not about regulation and regulating things. It's about innovations. It's about finding solutions and helping industry navigate through the variety of regulations that they might have for air quality, water quality, et cetera. But you see that culture also in the mining industry, in the oil and gas industry. You just see that, as you pointed out, they're rolling up the sleeves and finding solutions through innovation.
I've had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in the Powder River Basin, and what the industry has done and accomplished in reclamation has really been a success story. Working with good science, working with the people of Wyoming and the communities, what the industry has done is really remarkable in a pretty challenging environment to reclaim land.
Director Parfit, I know that the head of the federal EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, was in Wyoming just within the past few days as we sit here today. How would you describe or characterize the relationship between the state of Wyoming or your agency, DEQ, with the feds and EPA under a Democratic president's administration?
Administrator Regan came out at the invitation of the governor and spent some time with the governor so that Wyoming could showcase some of the good work that's happening throughout the state. A visit to the Integrated Test Center at the Dry Fork plant up in Gillette.
Yeah, Wyoming Chronicle was just there about a month ago, and very, very interesting site.
A lot of good research happening there, and then followed up by a visit to the University of Wyoming, and really the work that they're doing to take CO2 and create products. We also had an opportunity to talk about the carbon capture and sequestration, the Class 6 UIC program, and how important it is that as EPA develops rules moving forward, is that they focus on the outcomes and in such a way that you don't develop a rule that is going to preclude the outcome that we're all working towards. We do have frequent conversations with our EPA counterparts in Denver and back in Washington, D.C. There are some things that we just don't agree on, and that's always probably going to be the case. Is there's different ways of viewing an issue. You know, we have a shared interest in an outcome, but sometimes the way we choose to get there is different. My big concern is at the pace of new rules that are coming out from EPA, in the pace of the grants that are being offered up through the infrastructure bill and through the Inflation Reduction Act, you create rule and grant fatigue. But the real concern is that does EPA have the bandwidth, do the states have the bandwidth with all these new rules coming down to meet the existing timelines that are required? And what we see is that oftentimes EPA can't meet their non-discretionary obligation to meet requirements of existing rules. And so as you pile them on, then you fall further behind and you don't achieve the desired outcome.
I think I'm gratified to hear that our federal colleagues are visiting Wyoming, because I think quite often regulators in the hallowed halls back in Washington learn a lot from how we do things in Wyoming. Practical, common sense approaches, and I think the state can showcase a lot of good examples of maybe how our federal brethren could behave in meeting environmental challenges.
You know more about this particular difference, I'll put it that way, than many people might. Of course, you had a high-ranking federal position as the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. What did you notice about the differences between the way Wyoming tackled these issues and the way Washington did? I mean, obviously, the Fish and Wildlife Service is a much bigger agency, bigger responsibilities, but was there more to it, to the differences, than just the size?
I have to say my experience in Wyoming in the legislature and working with the Wyoming Game and Fish made me very conscious of how important it was to work with the states as partners, have jurisdiction over most of the wildlife. So I always looked to the states first as good partners, but my time chairing the Wildlife Committee in the legislature, working with landowners, industry, and hunters and fishermen across Wyoming was a good sounding for me going to the federal level.
Todd Parfitt, you came up through the ranks of DEQ as well. What was your origin and your first work you did for the department?
So I started with the DEQ in the Lander office back in 1992 in the underground storage tank program. And one of the things that I noticed right away was Wyoming had established a program, and to this day is, in my view, the best program in the country. We have the highest compliance rates consistently. You know, historically, you'd have these tanks that would then over time corrode, and you would have a release of petroleum into the subsurface. And through the storage tank program, we established installation and monitoring requirements for those facilities, which leads to fewer releases. But one of the unique things about the way Wyoming approached it was that through an insurance program, if you participated with the state program, the state would, through its funding mechanism, pay for the cleanup of the contaminated soils or groundwater. So there were around 1,600 contaminated sites across the state. And the way we approached it is we would go in, instead of individual sites, we would go into an area, a community, and address all of the leaking tanks at the same time, which gave us some cost savings.
There's some other legacy type actions and accomplishments that DEQ's done that you're we're proud of?
We have a what's called a voluntary remediation program that we developed, which you can have an entity come in and under that program work with our staff to develop a remediation plan. You know, the biggest one that I can think of was the Amoco refinery in Casper. And the work that's happened there has been incredible, but that took an effort of the local community being engaged with the DEQ. EPA played an important role in that as well, as did the it was BP and Amoco at the time. But that was incredible, and you look at that now, you have several buildings on that property now, including the Oil and Gas Commission office. You have a golf course there, and there's still remediation ongoing, but we're, you know, able to integrate all of that into the development into the remediation system itself.
If you could name a handful of top, maybe I shouldn't say headaches, challenges, issues, objectives that the department's dealing with now, what would some of those be?
As we like to say it, is Wyoming knows Wyoming. And what's important these days is the growth of the carbon capture and storage program, the Class 6 underground injection control for CO2. And that touches a lot of different industries within the state. So making sure that we're successful there. You've got the nuclear power plant that's being proposed over in Kemmerer, and we're engaged with that. Mainly we want to make sure that the state's interests are looked after, but also we don't want to get in the way and be an obstacle to an efficient process with the development of that project. There are what we call emerging contaminants. The perfluoral alkyl substances, PFOA, PFOS, you might hear more commonly referred to as. That's relatively new. EPA just came out with the water quality standards on that at 4 parts per trillion. So we're talking very small amounts that can have an adverse impact and cause health effects. And then there's the harmful cyanobacteria and where that shows up throughout the country as well is I would put in that emerging contaminant arena where we need to spend more time in the research arena, understanding why we see the cyanobacteria, where we see it, when we see it.
We're 50 years into DEQ in Wyoming. So how do we measure success?
I think we can clearly say that we're better off today than we were 50 years ago. We've been very successful as an agency in a lot of fronts. There's always more work that needs to be done. But the important thing is that we establish those that culture that continues on. We have dedicated professionals within the agency that deeply care about Wyoming. And we also understand the importance of working with the legislature to accomplish those goals.
Wyoming still has a lot which other states have lost in their airsheds, quality of their watersheds, airsheds, natural landscapes. And so Wyoming can continue to be a leader. They can continue to be a research lab for the rest of the country and how to do it right. So I think Wyoming, the nation can learn from Wyoming, and Wyoming citizens can be proud of laws put in place, departments in place, by people that have gone over the Great Divide.
Todd Parfit, John Turner, gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us on Wyoming Chronicle, and I've enjoyed the conversation. Best
thank you.
To you both.
Steve, thank you. Enjoyable visiting with you.
John, on behalf of the DEQ, I want to thank you and your fellow legislators for your wisdom and foresight in creating the Environmental Quality Act 50 years ago. You created an enduring foundation for today's DEQ and the DEQ of the future for the benefit of all Wyoming citizens.
Water is a defining feature of this planet. In its liquid state, it covers 70% of the Earth's surface, and its solid state is responsible for shaping much of what remains. When we reflect on these processes, we often think in geologic terms, thousands, if not millions of years. Rivers snaking from one bend to the other, glaciers carving canyons from mountains. Today in the continental United States, much of the glacial formation of the Rocky Mountains is complete. But the ice is still here. The valley through which the South Fork of the Shoshone River flows in northwestern Wyoming has one of the highest concentrations of ice falls in North America. For a few months every year, with its unique climate and topography, water and ice conspire to reshape this canyon into a new world. In as little as a few days, an area previously thought to be known will transform into an alien landscape. Loose, overhanging cliffs solidify with the cold and become draped in blankets of ice. The melting snow above continually adds to the formations, changing their shape and character a little every day. There's only one way to access these natural wonders. And for those who seek such adventure, they'll find their fill here.
The South Fork Canyon in Wyoming is this incredible valley, 36 miles outside of Cody. A dirt road leads you to a dead end. And from that point, no matter which way you walk, you're walking into wilderness. In fact, you're walking into one of the most remote places in the continental U.S. It gives you this sense of rawness and wildness that is really hard to find in the United States right now.
That wilderness has led a string of ice explorers to develop the area into a world-class climbing destination. In the 1980s, Kurt Cousins, along with his brother Todd and Monty Madsen, began establishing the first ice climbs in the canyon. Todd became particularly drawn to the South Fork, and through the mid-1990s, pioneered many of the largest and most popular routes to this day. Todd's first ascents were followed with the arrival of Aaron Mahlke in the late 1990s. With many of the obvious lines having already been established, Aaron has had to push the exploration for new ice even further.
Ice starts to form in October and runs into March or April. Ice comes and goes throughout that time. As the Earth rotates and the sun is hitting different spots at different times, and so there'll be ice climbs that don't form until maybe March. There'll be ice climbs that form in October, November, but then melt in January. Most of these ice climbs, the only way to get to that particular spot is to ice climb, because the ice is actually what allows the access into these cliffs and into these canyons. But that's also like the really unique thing about ice climbing, is that these things, you'll watch them for years, and then they're finally there, and you've got to go get them.
For over 20 years, Aaron has been leading the exploration in the South Fork Canyon. In that span, he's managed to pack in a lifetime's worth of first ascents, with over 100 to his name.
Not everybody's like me, where they want to choose the unknown. You got to be willing to go one step further than the last person, and that takes some drive, and at the end of the day, I really think it probably takes maybe an addiction. You get to go and climb this thing that nobody's ever seen, ever been on, and then to think that 2 months later, or sometimes days later, it's gone. It vanishes. It's no longer there. You're kind of lucky to be there. And the feeling that kind of comes with being the first, it's pretty awesome. Not only do you get to name it, but you know, it takes you back to hundreds of years ago, and why did the explorers go and explore, right? Like, well, to see what nobody else has seen. That is that wildness that the South Fork provides. The Absorca Range is quite large. Like, the South Fork Valley is really just one part. Like, I'm just picking away at this one small section on the map, and I get further and further into each little drainage and each little sliver. I mean, I'm 20 years and there's still stuff. And there will be stuff for my entire lifetime. And so until those places are all explored and I feel like everything has been touched and everything has been seen, I'll keep having my addiction. And then the hardest part about that is that valley that I went to 2 years ago and there was no ice, who's to say there's not ice there today?
And we welcome our viewers to this very special Wyoming Chronicle. We're taking into account the needs to have social distancing today, but still we're very, very pleased to be joined with Aaron Mahlke. Aaron, welcome to Wyoming Chronicle.
Thanks for having me.
Our viewers have just seen the wonderful Our Wyoming piece that we produced with you, so they, I think, understand just a little bit about ice climbing. But when did you start, Aaron? How did you get involved in the sport, I guess?
I got started in mid-90s, fresh out of high school and played soccer most of my life, and thought, you know, I was working with a friend that said, hey, you want to go out climbing? And I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. And next thing I know, I was out ice climbing. I think my third time climbing was ice climbing, and absolutely fell in love with it, and moved to Wyoming 2 years later.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up most of my life in California. Well, not most anymore. Most of my life is now in Wyoming, but I grew up in California and then moved to Colorado and was in Colorado for about 4 years and then moved to Wyoming in 1998.
So in the piece that our viewers saw just a moment ago, you talk about how really the ice climbing near Cody is really world class. What does that mean?
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely world class and world renowned. It's because of the concentration of ice that's in the valley. So the South Fork Valley has the highest concentration of ice in the lower 48 states. And it really is the topography and really just how that, the elevation of where that valley sits and the melt freeze cycle that happens through the winter that forms these massive ice falls that fall off of these cliffs all around you.
So we're recording this on April 2nd, a day before it airs for the first time. you could still be climbing now and even later into the season. Is that right?
Yeah, typically, I would still be climbing this time of year. But right now I'm staying at home and trying to be part of the solution. But normally I can climb into May, sometimes. It's really about how long do you want to go climb. Usually that warm weather really starts to pull you in and wants you to go do something that maybe isn't quite as cold.
So is that for you hiking in the summertime? Is it rock climbing? How do you round out your adventurism?
Well, I focus my early spring a lot on, I have a bunch of chickens and turkeys and things like that. So I really focus on getting that going. I try to raise most of my own meat. And then I start kayaking. So that ice starts to melt. I start following it downhill. And I've done about 4 or 5 first ascents in Wyoming and love kayaking. I love the exploration of really all of the rivers and creeks we have in Wyoming. There's so many fabulous ones to go check out.
On the thrill seeking scale, which is more adrenaline rushing for you?
Boy, it depends. Kayaking in general, for the most part, can definitely be a little bit more adrenaline packed because, if you're looking at a big waterfall or a big drop, there's no pause button. Whereas climbing, you could take on climbing a really serious ice fall, but a lot of those times you can take that moment and breathe. Whereas once you're in a river in the flow, there's no pause.
How have you learned about safety of the ice climbing sport? The footage that we have is just stunning, Aaron, and we watch you cut ice, cover your face. The ice drops below. We've seen video of an ice falling down to your person who's holding your rope for you, but yet they're protected. How do you learn about safety in this sport?
That's one of the unfortunate things about ice climbing. It's one of the best ways to learn is to do it. And those years of experience have allowed me to be able to look at an ice fall and decide, is this safe to climb? What are the dangers that are here? If something was to happen, let's think about how we're going to deal with those situations. And so it really is experience, because the ice is different from day to day, year to year. And so you have to kind of start to have this bond with the ice, if you will. And throwing that axe into that ice, you definitely start to kind of have a feeling of, is this ice good? Is it bad? What's kind of going on here? And really become one with it.
It seems to me that you could go to a place this week and it could be entirely safe. And next week, it could just entirely change. Or maybe even the next day.
Absolutely. This time of year, especially, right, we got these huge temperature swings and lots of different things that are happening there. So it could be great. Like today, it's 5 degrees here in Cody. The ice is probably fabulous, brittle, but fabulous. As it raises up in temperatures, then that stuff's going to soften up. There could be water running over the top of it. Things could be starting to detach from the rock. All those things have to be taken into consideration. The safest ice falls this time of year are the biggest ice falls, the most, the ones that are 4 or 5 feet, 10 feet thick and big and long. The ones that are dangerous are the ones that are really thin or hanging daggers and things like that. Those are going to detach from the wall quite quickly. There's just not much of a stability that's there.
So there's ice falls for where natural waterfalls are. There's ice falls formed from other snow melts that just form. Are there different styles of ice that you climb? And give us a description of what those might be.
Absolutely. Yeah, there is, there's big, fat, giant ice falls you get to go climb, and then there's pillars. So if you can imagine a piece of ice dripping off the top of your roof, and it hits at the bottom, right? And those things start to keep dripping, and eventually they touch together, and that's a pillar.
Okay.
And so you can climb those when they're really thin and scary, or you can climb them when they're really big. And then there's also mixed climbing. So, that icicle that's hanging on your roof, we then started to think, well, that thing's never going to touch. So let's figure out how to get to it. So then we started climbing the rock to go to the actual hanging chunk of ice. And that's called mixed climbing. So that's probably the newest, biggest thing that's kind of going on is because ice, there's only so much ice, although in Wyoming, there's still lots of ice. But the mixed climbing is really fun, and it's usually a much more challenging physically as well.
Give us an idea of the number of folks in Wyoming who participate in this sport. Are there a dozen? Are there 100? Do we know?
Gosh, as far as there's a lot of people that, there's not a lot of people. Obviously, there's not a ton of people in Wyoming that ice climb. But the ones that are pretty avid at it are been doing it for a long time. I think there's a lot of people that are more, looking for the weekend outing. There's not as many that are like, oh, I want to go hike in the woods with Mulkey for, 5 hours and maybe not climb. There's not as many of those people. But there are a few. I have a partner that lives in Douglas, Wyoming, and drives up just about every weekend to come climb in Cody. So they are out there, but there's not as many climbers as there are skiers, that's for sure.
A lot of rock climbers in Wyoming. Do those skills translate well? Or is it just like the difference between cross country and downhill skiing?
Yeah, they slightly transfer, but really, really they don't. A lot of rock climbers are not really into ice climbing. They don't, it's the cold, it's something different. And for them, it could also be their off season. I don't rock climb that much. Ice climbing is kind of my thing. But I've also found over the years that having kind of a pause and not being on a rope and tied into a rope, every month out of the year gives me an opportunity come September to recheck everything. You don't get complacent. And that's usually where accidents happen. But back to your original question is, yeah, the rock climbers, some of the movement is the same, but it is very different in a lot of ways.
The time that I felt most unsure about my next step or my next throw of my ice axe was when?
This year I had about an 80-foot pillar break, and it was the first ascent. It had never been done before. I knew looking at the pillar, it was really not structurally super stable. My partner and I talked about it. We chose to still go for it. So I climbed the mixed route to get onto this thing that I had bolted back in September. And it was important that we climbed this thing really quickly because it was very high up in elevation and a lot of snow accumulates. So your window of opportunity for this place was only about a month, maybe two. So we saw it. I thought that it was probably a 50-50 chance of this pillar breaking once I hit it. And sure enough, I hit it and the entire thing went crumbling to the ground. If you can imagine a chunk of ice, probably about 8 to 10 feet in circumference, crashing to the ground 100 feet below you. That was, at that swing as I went into it was interesting. And I was about 15 feet away from my last piece of gear. So I was looking at a pretty big fall. Thankfully, I didn't commit to that tool. Right as it hit, it pretty much snapped.
And that's probably an interesting point. You probably have to, swing your axe or put your foot in and then make sure before you commit. Like you're saying, is that the way the process works? You're testing, then pulling, and testing, and then pushing?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, when you know it's good, when you have a good swing, you know it's good. You start to feel that solid swing and that solid chunk of ice. But especially with really thin things, it could look so-so, and as you pull down onto it, it just breaks. So yeah, when you get into the really technical stuff, there's a lot of, you swing, you try it a little bit, put some weight on there, and then move along. The object for the most part is to try to get most of your weight into your feet and not so much in your arms. And that's really where technique becomes really important, because your leg muscles are a lot bigger than your arm muscles. So the last thing you want is to be getting pumped out of your mind and not be able to hold on to your tools anymore and looking at a big fall.
Aaron, give us a sense of the equipment that you use and what you have to take everything with you. What do you take?
Yeah. So you've got ice axes, and those are what you hold on to as you go up. You're swinging those into the ice. Then you have crampons. So if you can imagine, crampons are metal points that you put onto your boot that you're climbing with. So once you get to the ice fall, you'll put those crampons on, and they have basically two front points in them, or a single point, and you kick those into the ice. The other piece of gear that's incredibly important is ice screws. So if you can imagine like a wood screw, but imagine it being hollow, and as you put that screw in, something's going to come out the middle, right? So that's what an ice screw is sort of like, but much, much bigger. So an ice screw is usually, it could be about maybe 6, 7, 8 inches long, and about probably a half inch in diameter. So as you put that in, that's kind of your protection. Now, you really don't want to fall on those because they are strong, but they're only as strong as the threads and as strong as the ice is. The number one rule in ice climbing is really just don't fall. There's way too many sharp things on you, so you do not want to fall. I can think of, it's been many years, but the last time I fell ice climbing, I put an ice axe into my bicep. So you don't want to fall.
Ouch, ouch. So you continue to explore the South Fork. Where else is just top on your list for areas that you either want to climb or have climbed before in the, maybe even in the world, in, or certainly in all of the United States?
Yeah. You know, I've been to Norway several times. Norway is kind of an ice climber's Disneyland. There's lots and lots of ice in Norway. Not a very cheap place to get to, but absolutely beautiful, incredible. And then, you know, I spend a lot of my time here because there's still so much exploration still to be done. And it really is kind of my passion here. I just, you know, it's good to be at home and still be able to go and explore these places over, you know, 20 years later, I'm still able to walk up valleys and find new stuff, which is just remarkable. I just don't have enough time. I need to find more time to get all, to go climb all the stuff I want to climb.
You name many of your routes. What do you use for inspiration for what you come up with?
It's usually something maybe that happens during the day. Maybe there's something about that particular climb. It could be something that's going on within, you know, with your life as well. So it is, it's very personal. And it really depends on a lot of factors. And that's kind of the fun part, you know, is to go and climb this thing. And it could be just an experience that you had that really, that's how you name it. So the pillow that broke, I called it Warpath. You know, this big giant pillar fell to the ground and I was able to go back a week later and actually climb it and send it clean. And I called it Warpath. So you can have some fun with names.
Your coolest name you've named a route is?
Probably there's one called Tap Out. And that one's over in the Bighorns.
It sounds like you didn't make it up.
I actually did. but it's just like one of the most unique, gorgeous ice climbs probably in Wyoming. And it's, I can't even describe it because it's so gorgeous. But the colors and everything just, and I had gone to it twice before I got to climb it because it was really thin. And so I waited, as we talked about earlier, you know, is it structurally stable to climb? It wasn't. And so we ended up coming back a couple of times before I was able to decide that, okay, yeah, this thing looks like it's ready to go. So it needed to bake a little bit longer. So knowing when to tap out is always a good thing.
Give us an idea of the history of ice climbing in the state. Is the Cody area where it's happened first, or have there been other places? Give us a historical context about how people have worked this sport in Wyoming.
Yeah, you know, probably the original waterfall ice climbing. Again, I don't know, but I would imagine it probably started here in Cody. It started with Kurt Cousins, Todd Cousins. They were kind of the original pioneers of the valley. And they started in the 80s back then the 80s, the equipment was pretty bleak. And it was probably hard to find as well back then, but they were kind of the guys that started things here in the valley. And then by the 90s, mid to early 90s, people started kind of hearing about it a little bit, really kind of more the elite ice climbers at that point. Alex Lowe, Conrad Anker, some of those people started hearing about it and they started coming to Cody. And then I came in the late 90s, 98, and really just kind of hit the ground running and I'm still here, still going after it.
There are man-made places to ice climb in the United States and across the world.
There are. Yeah, there are now communities, Ouray, Colorado. There's a couple more as well that have now farmed the ice. So they've got maybe an irrigation ditch or a pipe of some sort. The one in Ouray is full sprinkler system. And there's actually, I think they employ like 5 or 6 people throughout the winter to run this thing. And people come from all over the place to climb in Ouray, Colorado. It's one of the largest ice festivals in the United States. And it has taken a community that really had not much going on in the wintertime. In fact, most of the hotels, restaurants closed, to now it's a very booming winter town in the wintertime.